Welcome to RPG Ramblings. This is normally a weekly show exploring the various details of the tabletop RPG hobby through discussions with interesting people. Unfortunately, I come alone. Life's been a little crazy between fretting my time away with disc golfing and then the demands of Kickstarters. I got a little bit behind. Well, I am a little bit behind. And I'm in a bit of a hole, but not too terrible of a hole. It's viewable. The edge is viewable. The end is, well, there is no end. But anyhow, enough of that. So in lieu of actually having a guest on, which would be reasonable, but it takes about, if I have somebody on as a guest, it generally takes me, with little settings as I do, about 4 to 5 hours of my time. So it still will take me probably for this podcast 2 hours, but it's a lot shorter. And anywho, that's the way it is. Not to complain, but just to realize that with a Kickstarter coming up right now, Gary's Appendix 4 is in full bloom, full whatever the term is, and it's doing pretty well. It's doing as well as Gary Appendix 3. As always, when it comes down to comparing how it actually seems to be aligned very much with Gary's Appendix 3. So we start looking at number of people from each issue, number of backers versus the amount raised. It seems like it's pretty well stable. It's kind of hard when you start putting out Kickstarters as often as I've been doing. It's hard to know how many people are saying, you know what, five Kickstarters is too much. Even though they're not all Gary's Appendix, it's three a year. So, but looking at the mix, I generally do have a fair number of new people coming on. So, with each one. So, anyway, it's always every Kickstarter is something to think about, to learn, to contemplate, and this one's no different. Working on actually, what's kind of got me a little bit behind is I have Gary's Appendix 5, I decided needs to go to in February for Zine Quest, because that's the one that's closest to being completed. Well, I say close to be completed. The one that's most likely to be completed. I've already started working on the bestiary. I have one bestiary that item that was taken out of Gary's Appendix 4, because Gary's Appendix 4... I had so many articles and so many words that I took out a bestiary item because I ran a page count. So I believe it's about 15,000 words for 48 pages. So boy, you're going to get your money's worth. The dollar or the amount spent per word is not going to be better. It's going to be the best for all you backers. So actually it's a sword and sorcery themed issue, as probably most of you know, but boy, I'm pretty excited about it. It's a very, 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 very fun issue. They're all, you know, they all have their high points, but I think the theme with the number of things that people have submitted, it's pretty exciting. So anyway, Gary's Appendix 5 will be coming out in February. So that really only gives me December to really get all the articles in, hopefully art ordered. Then it gives me a month to put everything together. And then it gives me in time for February for Kickstarter. Now, obviously, I'm not going to get everything in by the end of the month. Maybe I can. I've actually have two articles in already that have been submitted. So, but anywho, anyway, it's a tight schedule. I usually try and get my Kickstarters to be completed by the time I kickstart. So Gary's Appendix 4, which I kickstarted, started in end of November. As of right now, it's still going on. I just ordered my proof copies earlier this week. And, so it's actually, it's pretty much on time. It is on time. So, no worries there. So Gary's Appendix 5 will be in February, looking at, doing Journey to the Madlands, which is another item that from the days, from actually my second Kickstarter, 3 years ago, I ran Journey of the Madlands, a post-apocalyptic zine. And anyway, that was more of a number of people writing. This one is just, it's completely, well, no, it's not true. I have, I've added Stefan Surratt to the to the mix. So he'll be adding, he's got adventure in there, and then I'm also having him write the write a location. So we should hopefully have all the writing done with that in the end of the month. And then I also have all the layout done, have a lot of the layout already completed, but I just need to order art. So that one's on track. I also, Scoundrels of Brixton 3, Adam Kovac is hard at work. So we'll slot that in. Adam makes it so easy because he does such a good job writing. I have the hard part of simply just trying to get the words to fit in a way that looks really nice on the page. But and then I also have other stuff in development. So which I'm trying to get done. So who knows, maybe I'll have some adventures written this year that'll go to Kickstarter. Maybe a repurposing of an old product for a new system, which I'm very excited about. And and also working on an RPG, a sci-fi RPG, very, very, very early stages. So who knows what will come of that. So anywho, enough of my nonsense. Well, actually my personal nonsense, not to talk about the nonsense that was GameholeCon. So this is not intended to be a, wow, GameholeCon was so fun. Too bad you didn't get to go. How sad. That's not intended. Really what I'm looking at is going to the GameholeCon, going to conventions. I tend to go there hopefully with open eyes, and I have experiences, and I try and learn things, try to come away with new relationships, and also playing game systems. It helps me to, I guess to me, rather than just playing games, it offers a whole slew of opportunities to advance my craft and expand out my horizons. So anyway, the first game and the stuff I like to play different games for different reasons, but the very first game I played in was Luau Lu's The Dare Luck Club. So Lou's got this, it's not really Kids on Bike, but it's a Kids on Bike game. It's been out for a while. It is really modeled after, and you can correct me, but it seems to be modeled after more like the 80s style of games. I've not played Tales from the Loop. It didn't really seem like that. It really is more like the replaying the like Gremlins and various games where kids are involved in situations that kind of go sideways, and there's an element of danger to it. So the one we played was, I guess, in some ways reminiscent of Gremlins, but that wasn't it wasn't the main thing behind it. There was something else going on, but and what was also interesting is it ended up being a TPK. All the kids died. The funny thing is it was the very first game, so of all the slots that were available to me, so whenever you go to get a register for a game on GameholeCon, it opens on a Saturday and at noon, and you put stuff in your basket, things you want, looking at signing up for. But what happens is once the clock hits, right after it hits 11:59 a.m., that server locks up. When I say locks up, it goes very slow because there's thousands of people hitting it at the exact same moment. And so if you're going to GameholeCon, you've not done before, your best bet, the advice I give is pick two games that you know you want more than anything else to play. More than anything else, pick those. And then you pick kind of different paths where you have alternates that you can switch over to. So for me, the one number one was The Derelict Club with Luau Liu. That was the first one I picked. I got basically the first two picks without a problem. Then after that, it was alternate choices, which was fine. But I wanted to pick Liu. We spent a little bit of time in Game Hole Con. Not Game Hole Con, Gen Con. We went to dinner together. I haven't spent as much time with Liu as I'd like, but just an absolutely amazing guy. A lot of energy. And I thought, you know, if one thing I really want is to be in one of Liu's games. And so I picked his game that was scheduled for Thursday morning at 9 a.m. And unfortunately for Liu, I was the only one who signed up. So he waited and waited. We waited for a bit and very apologetic. But actually, I don't necessarily go to these conventions that I was happy to be in a game with Liu that Liu was running and actually play in a game system that he designed. So as far as I was concerned, there was no downside to this. And so it was very, very interesting. So the characters, let's see if I can remember properly. It's been a while. So it's a very flight system. And each character has a set number of D4s, D6s, D8s that they can roll. And it goes up to D10s. You go past that. And you can only roll those so many times. And then you cannot use any more of those, that dice set, or I say dice set, dice type, until you've used up all the slots that were available. Then they all reset. And characters have stats, and those stats are the number of dice they can use. So if it's I can't remember the stats, but say, let's say for instance, it's strength of three, which I can't remember if strength, but, or two is probably most common. You can, if you decided to use D6s, you'd roll two D6s. And so so it was both a trying to determine what was interesting about it is that you had some choice into padding your success. So, you know, if you wanted to use a D10, you were more likely to succeed. But if you use all your high dice in there early on, at the end, you're stuck with the low dice. And the GM also had had a similar system for the NPCs. So, it was a very fun game. It was, of course, my mind, I start thinking about other genres to use or how to use it. But Lou's very happy with the system, being just what it is. And I thought I was really impressed with the elegance of the mechanic, long-term statistically sound. I don't know, but it really did a good job of being a system that was commonly easy to access. It played fast at the table. It seemed like there was a bit more cognitive load than for the GM than I would care for as a GM. But then again, maybe I got used to it. It wouldn't be a problem, but it wasn't like overly complicated. It's just, it seemed like there's a little more work on his side. And each character had they had a few little details they could do, little superpowers they could do, a couple little problems that they would exhibit. And they also would be, what's also nice is you get to pick your equipment, so to speak, package deals, so to speak. And then you would utilize those items to be able to justify using skills in certain ways. So anyway, when I say skills, it really wasn't skills. It was like I can't remember, like panache and cleverness, or I can't remember the stats. But well worth looking at if you're looking for a new system, if you're looking for a game where it's the kids on bikes. Really much, I would recommend checking out The Derelict Club by Luau Liu. And so then I played at 3 o'clock. I played the Tower of the Black Pearl, which was my very first Merkburg adventure ever played in ever. The thing was, I was pretty shocked. Well, I should shocked. It was, so it's really a D20 system, and characters were probably more vulnerable than they generally are with OSE, with low hit points. The system was pretty deadly, by design, but was, I thought, and I forget what the target number was for most D20s, but it was simply just, I believe, if I recall correctly, a rollover system. So, mechanically speaking, I can't say there was anything that was, innovative. But I will say the what I really enjoyed about it and what I came up with was the magic items that the characters had. When I say magic items, they some were also not magic, they're just like poisons. So, and they were often very powerful. And so I found the combination of having super squishy characters with potentially powerful items that were not necessarily, they weren't necessarily like standard magic items or standard spells, but it could be like a very, very strong poison or whatnot. So it allowed characters to, or I guess we reward characters who are clever, and being able to utilize those magics to their benefit, as a reward, which I thought was fun. So, I mean, not that I recommend this, but you know, it's not the same, but you imagine like, well, what would happen if you give a first level character, a Holy Avenger or a Vorpal Sword, or a wand of fireballs or something like that. So they weren't that degree of being overpowered, and they also a lot of times required more thought, but the idea was very, very squishy people with just a few hit points, also having sometimes items that were very powerful. I had some takeaways from that were good. I would play another Mork board game, but I don't think I'd ever care to run it. And I don't know that I was necessarily in love with the setting or the system, but I definitely would not hesitate to ever play a Mork board game at a con. The other thing I found out was, I come to realize that, so I have undiagnosed ADD, so don't know that's true, but it seems that's what I have. And I noticed that with the room, with conventions, some of the rooms are very noisy, and this room was very noisy. And I find that through this whole convention, that if it's noisy, I have a hard time hearing. If I have a hard time hearing, I have a hard time paying attention. If I have a hard time paying attention, I feel drained at the end of the session. And so, because I would come out of these sometimes worn out and tired, and then I would go and see somebody, and all of a sudden my energy level would go back up. So I think that I cannot fix that, but I have noticed that I've wondered why sometimes during conventions I have a hard time paying attention. And I thought it was for different reasons, but it's the noise level. And I found with games at a higher noise level, problem, and games with low noise level, no problem. So anyway, if you're at a con and you find yourself in a similar situation, realize that, man, sometimes those rooms can make the difference between making it easy to pay attention or not. So that night I had dinner with Trevor Stamper and a couple of his friends. He's at groupies. I did not realize that Trevor Stamper has groupies. He has people that travel from other states to come and hang with him. So anyway, I got to be a groupie with, for Trevor. Absolutely delight. Time with Trevor and his friends. He can't beat that. So anyhow, great hangout, great food. But as an old man, I think I was in bed before 10. So Friday, don't remember the fellow's name. It's Andrew. I forget his last name, but he ran a Villains and Vigilantes game that, it was a time travel game, and, there were three parts, and it's taken me like 5 years to play all three of them due to COVID and different things. And yeah, it's definitely his games were absolutely a highlight. He mixed Star Frontiers with, if you imagine an acid trip and then combine it with Villains Vigilantes, then that's what you got. And now it's over, kind of bittersweet. You know, I've fulfilled my quest. So, and Andrew's such a wonderful guy. But anyway, Villains and Vigilantes by Jeff D. As the game we played, it was the original, not the newest version. It's playable as is. You know, the character sheet, the way he did the character sheet, it's just he didn't use the Villains Vigilantes character sheet, just did like a Word doc, and it was kind of messy, a little bit confusing. It does appear that the game does suffer from age. What is interesting, I got to peek behind the curtain, was that they have like saving throws, but this kind of like saving throws, but the saving throws are based on the character type that you are, which was, when I saw it, I was really, 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 really fascinated. So it's, you know, if you're a fire, if you're an elemental type person, maybe your saving throws for different things are one way. If you're a brick, they're another way. And it made me realize that, you know, both the modeling after Dungeons and Dragons, and also the breakaway, you know, you could see those things both breaking away from the Dungeons and Dragons model, but also the ways it embraced it. But we're talking like early or late 70s. So this is like, you know, this is people inventing. This was new technology at the time. So there are some things I believe that the newer version cleans up. And I think one of the things is movement, as was mentioned, is kind of jacked up in there. And there's a number of things that it's streamlined, but the GM chose not to use the newer version, which is fine. But I will say that, I don't know that I would pick up, for myself, Villains and Vigilantes, but you know what? I would never not play a game. If somebody offered to run a Villains and Vigilantes game at a home group. So, my goodness, it was a lot of fun. D20. A lot of fun. Then at the afternoon, there's this Ragnarok game called The Order of the Stag. It's a Ragnarok RPG. It uses runes. And not to be, I don't know how to describe it. If you see the books, are beautiful. I had in times past, determined, having seen it, I was very tempted to purchase the, books last year. And I can be impulsive. I just, you know, generally if I feel an impulse, it'll just back away. And I don't feel that same way after a few hours, and then we're okay. So I, you know, made my saving throw. But the system, and the books were on my mind, before I went to Game Hole Con, and I vowed to myself, I will not buy those books. Got there, and then I got done playing the Villains and Vigilantes game, and I looked at the next game, and it was Order of the Stag, the Ragnarok RPG. Forgot that I signed up for it. It was just one of those things where I, you know, one of the games I was wanting to play, but I couldn't remember. It's been such a long time. And I don't, as far as looking ahead, I didn't. And so ran that game. We played in that game, which is a Viking-ish, Celtic-ish. It's some ways kind of reminds me of, it's the Ragnarok has happened. The apocalypse is occurring, and there's a mishmash of kind of like with kind of like with the Hyborian Age, where you have like different civilizations sort of mashed together at the same time. So I mean, I believe there, if I recall correctly, there's like there's different medieval periods people kind of together in a way that probably doesn't make sense in a real world, but it's okay, it works out. It's there's nobody, you know, worried that there's, you know, these people from really that are from different periods of medieval and pre-medieval time periods is coexisting. But anywho, it had a very innovative, I'm stuck on that word, innovative system. It uses runes, and so there's different colors. There's like, I think, three different colors, and then you have a sheet, and you have things that you can do, but it's the runes power the activities. And then there's clever things you can do with linking runes together. They also represent the amount of actions you can do. So if you're wanting to run, you're going to spend a rune to do that. Some things require the same color rune. Some don't. Some require the same insignias on the rune. Some don't. And so combat is it was not an intuitive system, but I will say that we'll compare it to 5e. I think it had the same level of complexity as I said 5e, 3 or 3.5 of D&D. I mean, that same level of complexity. But it was once one started to understand how things worked, it was not difficult to work through. Even though there was the complexity with the characters and the things they could do, it didn't feel burdensome like it as much as it was with a 3.5. You've not played it, and all of a sudden you're playing a third level character, and you're just like bewildered by feats and this and that and this and that. It was, at least with the character sheet, it was very logically, the ones that we had were very, it was very logically laid out, and the game was set up to play where you don't, there's different levels of complexity. One does not have to use all those levels of complexity. So absolutely fun. Magic system was fun. It allowed a lot of flexibility. The drawing of using the runes both represent your ability to do actions, also represented hit points. And as you advanced in levels, so to speak, you could make choices of more things you could do or more runes to add to your bag. Because what would happen is that these runes would get mixed up in your bag and you'd draw from them blind. And so you might have powers, but you can't always, some powers you could always consider, or abilities or skills, or you could always consider the being able to do, but others, you know, required that rune. And sometimes, you know, if you have other runes that you could tag onto them, you could amplify or extend, or it's hard to describe. When I talked to the fellows, I went to when I went to buy the books, the fellow, I mentioned having played it, and he said, yeah, it is very difficult to learn to play the game, he said, from reading the books, which I thought was a very fascinating thing to fess up to. So it is, anyway, I heartily, is a great game system. It's a wonderful game to play. It is a probably one of the few games that mechanics combine with the narrative, and they work together in a way that I've not ever seen in another RPG. But I also know I'll probably never, ever, ever get to run this game, and I'll probably never play this game other than maybe at conventions. So that's a sad part. So I spent, I don't know, $150 for two books that will just sit on my shelf, and I'll read through occasionally because the art's amazing. But anywho, wow, it's crazy. It's good. And that night, there's a zine makers hangout. Zach Goins of World of Game Design. Threw out some pizza, and we had a good time. So it was a good time to hang out with peoples. Very enjoyable. Very, very, very. very enjoyable. So Saturday, Trevor Stamper and it's called Earth Crawl, and it is a mutant crawl classic sci-fi setting that he's got. That was my number two choice. That one was Luau Liu and Trevor. Those were the two high tie things I picked, and I got in on that game. The idea is like some of the other sci-fis where people in orbit, high science, but also politically messed up, sending people down to a ruined earth to harvest parts and salvage components and dealing with a mutated earth. So there's what he was wanting is I would say a lot of ways like a board game mechanic where the idea is characters going in and having trying through and determining where they're going to go, and seeing what things they find, what troubles they pick up through their trying to find salvage, the doing of the salvage and trying to return without losing characters. So he also was wanting to try out the card system where the characters would draw cards in certain areas and they would provide visual or sensory clues, but they would also indicate kind of randomize even things that were happening. So, which was good. And it was fun being part of the play test going through that. He's got a very solid game on his hand, which is pretty exciting. He, not a lot to say, but it'll be coming out eventually. He's been hitting the Kickstarter, see the conventions, playtesting, and revising. So it'll be interesting to see how that winds up. And so Saturday afternoon, I determined that I was I've used to do three sessions a day, and I would wear myself out. This time around, I decided I'm going to do two sessions a day, and just ensure I can be in bed by 10 o'clock, generally bed by 10 o'clock. But then I realized, man, I'm missing out all these people in the convention center, the exhibitors hall that I want to talk to. There's been a number of people that I want to spend some time with, which I haven't really been able to. And I was hoping that I canceled my second game. On Saturday ahead of time. And I was like, you know what? Once I'm done with Trevor's Earth Crawl, I'm just gonna hang out and find a few people that I just want to spend some time with and talk with and hang out and just chill at the visitor or at the exhibitor hall. But I had Zach Goins came up to me while I was walking out. Say, what are you doing right now? Blah blah blah. And he's like, hey, I got a game of Octoon Cthulhu 2D20. Are you interested in playing? I got an opening at the table. So like, well, I'm not going to say no to playing Octoon Cthulhu 2D20, which I've never played before. And I'm never going to say no to Zach Goins running a game. So I've never been in a Zach Goins game. Is that true? Yeah, I've never been in a Zach Goins game. But I also knew that I will never turn down an opportunity to go into a Zach Goins game, especially being invited by Zach Goins. So I didn't realize there'd be so many people at the table. I thought maybe he was just short on people, but no. Really, what's happening? I think there might have been seven or eight of us. So it wasn't like, I got two people, I really need three. It was like, no, I had eight people. One person came out. You want to join? So So mechanics wise, the game was fun. Probably not as is a little more loosey goosey than I would like. Except I just ordered the books from Modiphius due to their the Thanksgiving sale. So, but man, Zach didn't disappoint. Great game. But the fascinating thing, the absolutely mind-blowing bonkers thing about that game was there was four women there, and those four women were all they're all workmates. And to make it more unusual, I'm not sure which industry they're in. It might be real estate. I couldn't tell, but I will assume real estate, but I may be wrong. They were, their work had bought an Airbnb or had rented, brought them there, all expenses paid, weekend to play in, to play at Game Hole Con, to play role-playing games. The women range, I would say, from maybe late 20s to maybe early 40s. Some, you know, one dressed the nines, some not. But I mean, it was kind of interesting to see the dynamic. Their first game was Octon Cthulhu 2D20, they were actually apologetic about the whole thing, and the rest of us were like, you know, like, no, we're happy to have, and it was interesting to see, you know, them come to interface with a role-playing game for the first time, and how really, you know, Zach did an absolutely great job. The rest of us tried to make sure that, you know, they had plenty of opportunities to drive decisions and drive action and to do stuff. It was absolutely a joy to see them enjoy. And, you know, we're talking about a demographic that, you know, in our day, those of you out there, same age as me, this would never have happened. And here we have people who are, it was absolutely amazing. So anyway, the women all absolutely had a great time, brought out candy and had a bunch of candy bars and such. They threw on the table and we all had an absolute riotous time as I guess punching Nazis and solving mysteries and not dying. So anyhow, I guess in my mind, this goes to show that we geeks and nerds are winning. So my mind's still blown. So last but not least, the last thing, I had a panel with Zach later that night, but the main thing of the evening was dinner with Travis Miller. So Travis has been on the podcast, he's written articles, and an occasion we've chatted, but my goodness. So we just had dinner together. And then after having dinner together, we walked by Starbucks and still talking. And then of course went to the convention center. It was cold. Then we also got a convention center, and then we, then talked some more. And, it was, and some of the things we talked about, I mean, it was, you know, game things, life things. I can't remember all the things that we talked about, but one of the things I mentioned was how I really just feel in many ways that with society and people that I just don't fit in. I don't think that anybody's being, you know, exclusionary. It's just, I do not feel like at work, I've got, you know, coworkers are fine. We have a good time. We laugh. We joke around, do stuff. It's not that I feel antisocial, but I just, in general, I don't feel like I fit in. And I don't necessarily feel like left out and sad. It's just, it is a little bit bewildering. And except for when it comes to people like Travis and I say Trevor and Zach and all the people who are in this creative space. With these people, I feel the opposite. And even though I don't make an effort to regularly be in touch, whenever we talk, there's not been any time that's passed. It's things are picked up right where they left off. Because as you mentioned, I think with as I'm getting older, I think I find myself especially with work being more direct. And so sometimes I reach out to people. A lot of times I'm very direct, like, hey, this or that, or this or that, I'm looking for this, or hey, can you help me with that, without going through the niceties of you know, hey, how's your day? How's it going? And in fact, one of the times I was contacting somebody, I went through that. And then later on, that person contacted me with just a very direct out of the blue question. I realized, you know what? All those little niceties we don't need. We're in tune. There's no feeling like the other is not like emotionally in touch or whatever. So, which I relayed that to Travis, and he talked about this quote from Timothy Leary. So the phrase really is find the others. I went and looked up the quote. I like most of it. The problem is there's a little bit of condescending to a certain point in some of his delivery. But the general message, I'll abbreviate it and take out some words. But he says, admit it, you aren't like them. You're not even close. You may dress yourself up as one of them, watch the same television shows they do, maybe eat the same fast food they do. But it seems that the more that you try to fit in, the more you feel like an outsider, watching normal people as they go about their existences. And then he says, and he talks about how connecting with certain people, you can learn certain aspects. And he says, nobody comes into your life by mere coincidence. Trust your instincts, do the unexpected, and it follows up with find the others. And the idea is, it's easy to look around and say that we don't fit in with this group or that group, or I don't necessarily fit in with people at work, or I don't necessarily fit in with certain family members, or I don't fit in at church. I don't fit in. You know, I think that's the other thing is, you know, that it's like the church is probably a place I feel like a person should automatically feel the most part of community, but it's probably the place that I feel the most alone. It was what I shared with them. And I find that interesting why that is. And find it interesting why it is. It just perplexes me. And so I don't understand. And so, but after, you know, looking at this quote, the idea is find the others. And there are others. And I realize now that there are people, I think the others like me, we do not, we're not good about intentionally contacting each other. So I did make a commitment to myself that I still haven't done, but I think for some of the others, at least people I've identified as others, I need to make a regular time of contacting them. It's easy for me to get in my mode of getting ready for the next Kickstarter, or my mode of you know, doing different duties, doing different things, but leaving aside the connecting with others, and I think that's important. And we are out there. And so, and it just may take work to make those connections. And I find that it's one of the reasons I've done the podcast is I'm pretty sure is that it has been a means for me to, find like, not necessarily just find others, but, probably engage in conversations that I find interesting, that I don't get elsewhere. So from Kickstarters to game philosophy to supply chain to random nerd nonsense, it's hard to find people that you can just discuss and thoughts and work things out. So anyhow, I will encourage you, I guess ending this, I'm not sure how long I've been talking, but for you as well to admit it, you're not like them. Those people around you, you're not even close. And you need to find the others. So anyway, good luck doing that. And until next time, take care.